in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Today is Monday, January 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the UK warns of severe sanctions if Russia invades or installs a pro-Kremlin leader in Ukraine.
We're standing shoulder to shoulder, saying there'll be very serious consequences if Russia takes this move to try and invade, but also install a puppet regime.
President Joe Biden says, quote, there is some progress, unquote, after 8 rounds of talks between Iran and world powers.
It's not time to give up. There is some progress being made. P5 plus one is on the same page, but remains to be seen.
And the head of the U.S. Africa Command warns of threats across the continent. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. A senior UK minister says Russia will face severe economic sanctions if it installs a puppet regime in Ukraine. This after Britain accused the Kremlin of seeking to install a pro-Russian leader there. London made the accusations late on Saturday, also saying Russian intelligence officers have been in contact with a number of former Ukrainian politicians as part of plans for an invasion. The Russian Foreign Ministry dismissed the comments as, quote, disinformation, unquote, accusing Britain and NATO of, quote, escalating tensions, unquote, over Ukraine. Moscow has insisted it has no plans to invade. UK Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab.
We're standing shoulder to shoulder, saying there'll be very serious consequences if Russia takes this move to try and invade, but also install a puppet regime. I certainly think financial sanctions, properly targeted and done in concert with our major partners, is something that we would readily look at, or already willing and engaged in training programs to support the Ukrainians defending themselves. That's absolutely right, for defensive purposes. Secondly, as I made clear, we want to make sure that the economic cost to the Kremlin of doing so is sufficiently severe that they think twice. What we want, and the Americans are engaged in the diplomacy, Liz Truss, the Foreign Office are as well, we want Putin to step back and realise how damaging this would be for him, let alone for Ukraine and the international community. The two things that the Kremlin care about are, would they get locked into a quagmire in Ukraine? I think there's a very serious risk of that. But also, will they suffer an economic price? And of course, things like Nord Stream 2 and what the Europeans are willing to do on that.
That's UK Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab. The United States began shipments of lethal aid to Ukraine after US President Joe Biden recently said that any Russian troop movement into Ukraine would be considered an invasion. President Biden's comment came as Russian President Vladimir Putin stations more than 100,000 troops along Ukraine's border. Russian and US diplomats so far have agreed to keep working to lower tensions. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more.
The first shipment of lethal aid from the United States arrived in Ukraine after officials from Washington and Moscow on Friday agreed to keep working to ease tensions over concerns of a Russian invasion in the former Soviet Republic. The U.S. Embassy in Kyiv says the shipment contains more than 90,000 kilograms of aid like weapons and ammunition. This all comes as British intelligence warns of Russian plans to install a pro-Russian president in Ukraine, which Moscow denies.
We've given Russia two paths. There's a path of diplomacy and dialogue, one that I engaged in with Foreign Minister Lavrov just last week in Geneva. But there's also a path of its renewed aggression and massive consequences that we have been building now for many weeks. And it's not just us that's saying it. The G7, the world's leading democratic economies, have been clear about that. The European Union's been clear about that. NATO's been clear about that.
Amid rising tensions with the West, Russia's defense ministry published these images Saturday showing Russian, Iranian, and Chinese warships in joint military drills in the Gulf of Oman with a promise of more to come. Meanwhile, U.S. lawmakers are weighing their options to de-escalate rising tensions.
I do think we should take up and pass a bipartisan bill that will show resolve and determination and apply some sanctions now. But the very strongest sanctions, the sorts of sanctions that we use to bring Iran to the table, is something that we should hold out as a deterrent to prevent Putin from taking the last step of invading Ukraine.
Russian fighter jets, seen here in a video published Saturday by the Russian Defense Ministry, began flights to Ukraine's neighbor Belarus, where Belarusian officials say they're hosting combat readiness drills.
so far with this administration, we have seen a doctrine of appeasement, and that certainly is not going to deter President Putin and Russia from invading Ukraine. So let's make sure that we are pushing back right now with stiff sanctions, making sure that we are showing Putin we do mean business.
So far, the main sticking point in negotiations between the West and Russia is the Kremlin's insistence that Ukraine never be given entry to NATO, a non-starter for the U.S. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
President Joe Biden says, quote, there is some progress being made, unquote, after 8 rounds of talks between Iran and 6 major world powers over Iran's nuclear ambitions. But a prominent member of that group, Russia, has been holding its own discussions with Iran's leadership. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House on what the future might hold for these sensitive negotiations.
Major world powers have spent months holding delicate talks with Iran in hopes of resurrecting the 2015 agreement to curb Tehran's nuclear weapons program. The agreement was ruptured in 2018 when former President Donald Trump withdrew the United States from the deal. The 6 nations who entered the pact, known as the P5 plus 1, have allowed Washington and Tehran to speak indirectly since President Joe Biden resolved to rejoin the agreement last year. In 2019, Iran began to incrementally violate the restrictions, alarming the West. The 8th round of talks ended this month without significant progress, but Biden said he's optimistic.
It's not time to give up. There is some progress being made. P5 plus 1 is on the same page, but it remains to be seen.
But are the members in agreement? As Biden spoke, Russia, another member of the group, met separately with Iranian officials. On Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin hosted Iran's president, who appeared to say the 6 parties may not be entirely in lockstep.
We are in a unique situation that has created considerable cooperation between the two countries against the West's unilateralism and American power.
Those who have been watching Iran closely say there may be reason for hope. Robert Lifuck is Senior Vice President and Director of International Security Studies at the Wilson Center think tank.
I think the basis for President Biden's assessment is that analytically, a deal is evident, and that deal would entail Iran coming back into compliance with its obligations under the 2015 nuclear agreement in return for sanctions relief and an extension of the sunset provisions that would have ended the constraints on Iran's uranium enrichment program. So analytically, you can see the structure of a deal. But the question is whether there's political space in Tehran to seal the deal.
VOA asked White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki to shed light on why Biden is optimistic.
We're in the diplomatic negotiations, and we've been very clear about where we stand on what we would agree to. But again, I don't have anything to read out for you beyond the status of where they are now.
Could this escalate? Litvak says there may be a third path.
If diplomacy fails and there are major constraints on the use of force, the third alternative is America's traditional default strategy toward adversarial states, which is containment and deterrence. And that strategy worked against Stalin's Soviet Union, Mao's China, and the Kim family's North Korea. The proponents of the military option should diplomacy fail are arguing that Iran's regime is uniquely dangerous and irrational. And that assessment runs up against the national intelligence estimate by the intelligence community, which argued that Iran operates according to a cost-benefit analysis.
So could a breakthrough happen now after 8 rounds? Maybe. On Thursday, Iran's president told Russian lawmakers the regime is not seeking nuclear weapons and is serious in reaching an agreement, if the other parties are serious in real and effective removal of the sanctions. Anita Powell, VOA News, at the White House.
The head of the U.S. Africa Command says security threats are growing across the continent. In his first on-camera interview since taking command 2 years ago, General Stephen Townsend spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Barb about his increasing concerns, including the spread of violent extremist groups, the role of Russian mercenaries, military inroads by China, and threats from Iran.
The U.S. military has now confirmed reports that Russian mercenaries known as the Wagner Group are in Mali. General Stephen Townsend, the commander of U.S. Africa Command, told VOA Thursday that Mali's junta brought in hundreds of foreign fighters to protect their regime.
Wagner is in Mali. They are there, we think, in numbering several hundred now. They're deploying there, supported by the Russian military. Russian Air Force airplanes are delivering them. The world can see this happening. So it's a great concern to us. And the reason it concerns me and it concerns the neighbors there is we have watched Wagner, this mercenary outfit, work on the African continent. We've watched them in the Central African Republic, Sudan, Libya. They don't follow anybody's rules but their own. They will exploit the country. They will create, they will break laws. They will do gross violations of human rights. They will kill innocents and civilians. And then when the Malian people get tired of them, they won't leave.
Townsend, who took over U.S. Africa Command in 2019, also told VOA the most active global competitor in Africa is not Russia, but China. Beijing, he says, is following billions of dollars of economic investments on the continent with creeping, steady, and strategic military investments. In 2017, China's military opened up a base in Djibouti, just a few kilometers away from Camp Lemonnier, the United States' only military base in Africa. The general said Beijing now looks to Africa's western coast, intent on building a military airbase or naval facility in Equatorial Guinea.
They're putting chips down in all these countries on the Atlantic coast. They know that they won't get a yes in many cases from many of those countries. But by asking and trying to get a base in all these countries, one or two of them may say yes. And we think that the place that they've got traction right now is Equatorial Guinea. We're not asking them to choose between China and us. What we're asking them to do is consider their other international partners and their concerns, because a Chinese military base in Equatorial Guinea is of great concern to the U.S. and all of their other partners.
In addition to Chinese military expansion, Townsend said he's monitoring a less obvious threat to U.S. interests on the continent, the one from Iran.
We are starting to see them express increasing interest in Africa and starting to make some inroads there. I think their inroads are going to be malign in nature. And so we're just keeping an eye on it. That's very nascent, but it's happening now, and we're watching it.
Can you give us any examples? Can you get into a couple of examples of that?
I'll just say that they're intelligence-related, and they're the arm of the Iranian security apparatus that engages in malign activity in the Middle East is the same arm that's now engaged on the African continent.
A U.S. official confirmed to VOA that after a U.S. drone strike killed Iran's elite Quds Force leader Qasem Soleimani, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps plotted assassination attempts on American diplomats in Africa and is still looking for revenge targets there. Iran has dismissed the accusations as baseless. Due to concerns over increased threats, officials say in the past year, the U.S. military has brought in new and improved defense systems and anti-drone weapons to Camp Lemonnier. The Pentagon has just completed a global posture review of U.S. forces and military resources around the world, a review that Townsend says, quote, ratified AFRICOM's current posture. The command did, however, lose some funding for military exercises with African partners. And for the last year, Townsend says he has shuttled troops in and out of Somalia. Donald Trump ordered most of the 800 U.S. troops out of the war-torn country in 2020 in one of his last foreign policy moves as American president.
They are in bases in the region, and we commute to work. And so who's in Somalia every day is less than 100.
How's that affecting the mission?
We are working hard to get our tasks done. I think that there's more effective and efficient ways to do that. We provide those recommendations to the Secretary of Defense, and we're waiting for decisions there.
But as Townsend awaits decisions from the Pentagon, political infighting continues in Mogadishu, where al-Qaeda affiliate al-Shabaab is adding to its ranks.
The threat of al-Shabaab is growing, and if increased pressure is not applied to al-Shabaab, I'm concerned that there's going to be a significant al-Shabaab attack. We've seen just suicide bombs going off in Mogadishu over the last 2 weeks. So I think they're expanding and they're a growing threat.
The January 12th attack on the Somali capital killed at least 8 people. Carla Babb, VOA News.
Heavy gunfire erupted inside a Burkina Faso military base early Sunday, sparking fears that a coup was underway in the West African country. Reporter Henry Wilkins managed to enter the base where a mutiny was taking place after being detained by the soldiers. They later released him with a list of demands. He has this report.
Arriving at Ouagadougou's largest military base, Camp Sangoulé-Lamizana, the sound of sporadic gunfire could be heard coming from inside. As we tried to approach, mutinous soldiers, their faces covered with bandanas, fired shots in the air and shouted at us to leave. I was with a journalist from the Associated Press. We rode to a nearby highway which runs the length of the base to try to get some elevated shots. Soldiers outside the walls of the camp spotted us, and we drove away quickly, but were soon stopped by troops who walked out into the road and fired shots in the air before training their guns on us. We threw our hands up. Shouting in French, the soldiers took our bags, cameras, and our motorcycle and walked us along the wall of the camp to a highway intersection where a crowd of about 100 people, some waving Burkinabe flags, had gathered. Shortly after that, around 20 soldiers fired into the air and shouted at the crowd to move back. While some soldiers were shouting at us, others told us it was going to be okay, and they didn't intend to harm us. I began to wonder if we were being taken hostage. At the entrance to the base, soldiers blockaded the gates with armoured vehicles. They took us inside and reunited us with our camera equipment and motorcycle. After around 15 minutes, they told us we were free to go. But not before they called one of the organisers of the mutiny on a phone to give us their list of demands. This is a recording of what was said. The speaker said we want enough troops to assist us in the fight against terrorism, more money and more troops. The soldiers also said they wanted the chief of the intelligence service and the military chief of staff to be replaced. They asked for better care of the wounded and family of soldiers who have died in the conflict, better training which is adapted to terror threats, and the organisation of a permanent military unit on the front lines, not one that changes with rotations. The demands were given by a captain who declined to be named. Burkina Faso has been embroiled in a conflict with terror groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State since 2015. Rumours of a coup have been rife for weeks after a military base in the north of the country was overrun by terrorists, killing 49 military members. President Roch Kabore fired members of his cabinet and military leadership in December in response. On January 11th, the authorities announced they had arrested members of the military who were planning to destabilise the institutions of the republic, causing many analysts to speculate a coup plot had been foiled. Speaking on national television Sunday morning, the Burkinabe Defence Minister, Ami Bartholomé Simpaoré, stated that the president had not been detained as rumoured. He also said the motive behind the gunfire was still not clear. Inside the base, however, it was clear the mutinies had taken over the camp entirely and did not intend to relinquish control until their demands were met. By the time we left the base, mobile internet network had been cut and information about further developments related to the mutiny was scarce. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says thousands of Eritrean refugees in Ethiopia's embattled northern Tigray province are living under life-threatening conditions because they have no access to humanitarian aid. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN refugee staff members say they were shocked by what they saw when they visited the Mai Eni and Adi Harush camps for Eritrean refugees in southern Tigray for the first time in 3 weeks. Intense fighting and security concerns have prevented them from going there until now. Boris Cheshikov, a spokesman for UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, says the team found refugees scared and struggling to get enough to eat. He says they lacked medicine and had little or no access to clean water.
Refugees told UNHCR of increasing preventable deaths, more than 20 over the last 6 weeks, linked to the overall decline in conditions and in particular, the lack of medicine and health services. The clinics in the camps have been essentially closed since early January, when they finally completely ran out of medicine.
Conditions in Tigray have seriously deteriorated since the Ethiopian military incursion into the province in November 2020. The civil conflict since has spread to other regions in northern Ethiopia. An effective blockade has prevented humanitarian aid, including fuel, from reaching the area since mid-December. Cheshikov says extreme hunger is rising because supplies cannot be moved into the region. He says food is running out in the two camps, and refugees have been selling their clothes and few belongings to get food.
If food, medicine, fuel, and other supplies cannot be immediately brought in, and if we continue to be unable to relocate refugees out of harm's way to where we can provide them with life-saving assistance, more refugees will die.
The UNHCR says it wants to relocate the more than 25,000 Eritrean refugees remaining in the two camps to a new site provided by the Ethiopian government in the neighboring Amhara region. The agency is calling on all parties for a ceasefire and guarantees of safe passage to allow the operation to go ahead. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, authorities in Cameroon say at least 17 people have died and seven others are seriously injured after a fire broke out at a nightclub and spread to an area where cooking gas was stored. A government statement says a series of loud explosions erupted amid the blaze in the Bastos neighborhood in the capital Yaoundé. The government suggests that fireworks had started a fire on the building's roof that spread. The tragedy comes as the West African country hosts thousands of soccer players, fans, and officials for the month-long African Cup of Nations soccer tournament. The nationalities of the victims are not immediately known, and some injured people have been taken to hospital. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Efforts to aid the tens of thousands of people affected by Tonga's disastrous volcanic eruption are beginning to gather momentum with the first arrivals of aid by plane and boat from New Zealand and Australia. Again, Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The full scope of damage and needs is still unknown. However, humanitarian agencies say about 87% of the South Pacific Islands' 100,000 people have been affected by the volcanic ash and tsunami triggered by the underwater eruption. Assessments of the damage from government and international sources are slowly trickling in. They find the biggest priorities to be that of restoring telephone and internet links, as well as the provision of safe drinking water for about half of the population. The World Food Program warns of potential food shortages because all agricultural sectors have been badly affected, from crops to livestock and fisheries. WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says initial estimates show up to 12,000 agricultural families have been affected.
Roughly 60 to 70% of livestock-rearing families are estimated to have been affected. Given the enormity of the eruption, it is likely most families could do nothing to protect or save their livestock from perishing. And for those that survived, there may be very little grazing pasture and uncontaminated water supplies left.
While a large-scale aid operation is finally getting underway, the United Nations warns the volcano is still active and Tonga is not yet out of danger. Another concern is that Tonga, which is free of COVID-19, remains so and not have the coronavirus enter the country during the delivery of aid. The spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says the first rule of humanitarian action is to do no harm. He says very strict protocols are in place to prevent that from happening. He says all agencies will abide by what he calls a no-contact delivery.
The pilots staying in the cockpit, a ground crew of local folks unloading the plane, and the pilots taking off without exiting the plane. It can also be a ship's going to port and being offloaded by cranes, so also so that the ship crew do not actually get into the island.
The World Health Organization says all medical and healthcare facilities on the island are operational. It notes the air is toxic because of the ash and dust raised by the volcanic eruption, and says it is urging people on the island to stay indoors and wear masks when they venture out. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kurdish militiamen allied with the U.S. continue to battle Islamic State militants for control of a prison and surrounding areas of a northeastern Syrian town of Hasaka. Arab media reports that U.S. tanks and helicopters have arrived in the area to help Kurdish forces after IS took control of the prison and several adjacent neighborhoods. Thursday, dozens of Islamic State militants and Kurdish militiamen have been killed in the fighting. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Kurdish fighters from the U.S.-backed QSD militia traded arms fire Saturday with Islamic State militants who continue to control the Goran prison in the northeastern Syrian town of Hasaka and several districts near the prison. At least several dozen Kurdish militiamen and more than 50 Islamic State militants reportedly were killed. Arab media showed video of U.S. tanks and armored personnel carriers arriving in the area surrounding the prison to help Kurdish forces in the fight to recapture the prison and adjacent neighborhoods. Syrian government TV showed video of dozens of civilians fleeing their homes in areas surrounding the prison that IS prisoners had infiltrated. Part of Hasaka is under the control of Kurdish militia forces, and another part of the city remains under Syrian government control. Rami Abdul Rahman of the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights told Arab media that U.S. Apache helicopters have destroyed a former government trade school building in which IS militants were hiding, killing at least five of them. Abdul Rahman also accused the Syrian government of using the Islamic State prison breakout to try and expand its control over parts of Hasaka. Tribal leaders in the region held a short press conference captured on amateur video in which they accused neighboring Turkey of trying to use the Islamic State group to foment a conflict among ethnic and tribal groups in the north of Syria and in neighboring Iraq. Islamic State militants also attacked an Iraqi army outpost in Diyala province early Friday, killing 11 government soldiers. Families of the victims accused IS of killing the soldiers while they were asleep and disabling cameras in the area. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA the prison breakout and battle for control of part of Hasaka is a crisis that has been brewing for a long time. He says several thousand Islamic State prisoners were being held in an old government technical school that normally holds just 1,000 people, and that the Hasaka prison, as well as the more well-known Al-Hol prison, have been breeding grounds for Islamic extremism. The current crisis, he argues, was just waiting to happen. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV broadcast a 2020 interview with an Islamic State prisoner in a Kurdish-run prison, claiming he intended to break out of the prison and that other Islamic State group members would not allow their prisoners to remain jailed indefinitely. One Syrian tribal leader asserted that the Kurdish militia that controls the prisons had released many Islamic State prisoners whom he claimed have gone back to the areas they once controlled to try and stir up trouble. Arab media accused several countries active inside Syria and Iraq of responsibility for supporting the Islamic State resurgence, but Khatar Abu Diab emphasizes it is impossible to prove any of the accusations. He notes that IS has been supported at various intervals by both Turkey and Iran, and says several other countries that are active in the region also have been accused of supporting the group. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Achebe in Washington, wishing you a great day.
This is the Voice of America, Washington. Ba-ba-boos.